and welcome to What Goes Up, a weekly markets podcast. I'm Mike Regan, a senior editor at Bloomberg. And this week on the show, the U.S. equity market has almost doubled since its lows during the COVID sell-off of 2020. But the rally has stalled, and the S&P 500 has basically gone sideways over the last 3 weeks, despite what's clearly been a strong earnings season. So where does that leave us going forward? Has the easy money all been made? We'll talk to a strategist who has some thoughts on what market stage we're actually in, and why he's looking across the U.S. border into Mexico and Canada for stocks that will benefit the most from the key themes of 2021. But first, Charlie Pellett, tell us who this week's mystery co-host is.
This week's mystery co-host is Divya Balji. Divya is the team leader for Bloomberg's equity market coverage in the Americas. She lives in Toronto and loves the Raptors, but she is not a fan of hockey due to all the fighting. Food and travel are her passions, and believe it or not, she says that's why she prefers New Jersey over New York.
Divya, my heart grew three sizes when I heard that you preferred New Jersey over New York. Not that I have anything against New York, great city, great state, but finally some respect for us here in the Garden State. But I got to ask, what makes you bullish on New Jersey, especially the food? I'm curious.
You know, I'm pretty sure I'm going to get a lot of hate tweets from saying this, but it just kind of feels like New York's a bit overrated at this point.
Wow.
And having spent a lot of time in Jersey, we've got family there and, you know, the food's great. You know, people are friendly. There's a lot of space. I really like it.
I love to hear it. Direct your hate tweets at Divya, not at me. Actually, you can direct them to me too. I'm curious. Curious what they say about that one. But hey, New Jersey just ranked the number one state for pizza by Food and Wine magazine. So the respect is finally coming. It's finally some respect for the Garden State. But let's get to that markets chat. We're very happy to welcome back to the show. This is actually his third time on the show. I think he gets a tote bag or something for that. But he is the director of global market strategy at StoneX Financial. His name is Vincent Deluard. Vincent, welcome back to the show.
Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, Vincent, I've been reading some of your notes, and you've got a pretty interesting, what I consider kind of a non-consensus view of sort of where we are in the market cycle. And correct me if I'm misinterpreting you here at all, but you sort of have disregarded the very fast bear market of last year as something that did not, in fact, reset the market cycle and does not make this a new, younger bull market that's only, say, a little over a year old. Rather, you see it as sort of just a continuation of the long, decade-long post-financial crisis bull market. So walk us through your thinking on that and sort of what that means for returns going forward or volatility going forward if we are kind of late in the cycle of a bull market.
So the first discrepancy, I think, is just the speed of the gains. We're looking at, you know, basically doubling on the S&P 500 index in about a year, which, again, does not happen typically. I mean, typically, the classical saying is stocks take the elevator down and the stairway up, right? Typically, it's when you rally, it takes longer to get there. Here, we had such a nice, clean V that is more consistent with what we saw during the Great Depression when we had a lot of these very brutal bear market, but also bull markets. I mean, some of the fastest rallies in history happened in the 1930s, but of course they were not sustained. Second indication that we are still in a in the same cycle as before is the weakness of buybacks. So in a bona fide bull market, what you see is as stocks valuation are depressed and earnings are coming back, cash flow is improving, you see companies buy back more of their stocks. This is happening to some extent, but we're still about 50% off the levels that we were pre-COVID. And a lot of the buybacks that we are seeing are really just coming from the tech sector, where this is not really a buyback. It's a way to offset the dilution from stock-based compensation. So you see buybacks, but you don't see the float shrink. Speaking of float, another inconsistency that we're seeing is this massive increase in equity issuance. We had the biggest month, quarter on record, much, much higher than what we had during the internet bubble, as companies have been really just taking advantage of these extraordinary valuations to raise equity. Again, not something that you would see at the bottom. Same thing with insider selling. I mean, typically at a major market bottom, you see, you know, insiders sell less and buy more. Where we see the opposite, we're seeing, especially among big tech companies, Nasdaq insiders are just cashing it out. And then the last part that's not consistent with a new bull market is the behavior of retail. So typically at the dawn of a new bull market, you know, there's a lot of distrust, there's a lot of fear. So the money is more like players like Warren Buffett, long-term investors that are, you know, brave enough to tip their toes. Here it's the exact opposite, right? You see, you know, obviously cash level at Berkshire is at close to a record high. And on the other hand, we had the largest inflow in ETFs ever for the past 8 weeks. So we are seeing basically corporations and insiders cashing out, retail buying in, which is typically what you see at major market tops, or at least at the end of a bull market, not at the beginning.
So Vincent, I guess, you know, I might be a bit more skeptical about this. I mean, there's a lot of things at play here, right? I mean, this market is so different from anything we've ever seen in the past. You know, obviously, there are companies that could possibly be cautious about doing buybacks right now. They might be waiting for just a little bit more normalcy, you know, and from that buybacks perspective as well, U.S. banks also just recently got the okay to buy shares or to purchase shares. That should help with the comeback as well. And also the retail buying that we've seen is also pretty unprecedented given the environment that we've been in. How do you sort of, you know, say, okay, I'm looking at this and, you know, no, really, this is why this we're coming to the end of the bull market. I mean, there's also the option of like, Tina, where what are your other opportunities out there to actually put your money in?
Yeah, these are good, all very fair points. I agree with you that this is unprecedented. Obviously it is. And in a way, it makes me feel like we should even discard everything that happened, you know, between March 2020 and today. And this is what makes me think that we are still in that same cycle. I mean, you mentioned the word Tina. I mean, this was the mantra of the past 10 years. So... yes, same thing, retail investors. Sarah, whom I, you know, I'm sure we all regret that she's no longer here. You know, she used to run these stories very early on the retail mania. And I remember having this conversation with her, like saying, well, oh no, these guys are going to go away. You know, it's retail investors, the weekends. I mean, this has been a big surprise how sustainable this has been. I still think, again, I've been wrong on this before, and I may still be wrong, but I think eventually this is not the ingredient for a sustainable bull market. I mean, you don't build economic prosperity on Dogecoin and GameStop and meme stonks. I mean, it's all fun. Everybody's having a good time now, but, you know, you really don't have the ingredients for sustainable economic growth. On this. On the banks, I thought you raised a very interesting question. And it's key to me for the debate on the inflation and the nature of the recovery. One thing that is stunning is that we've seen a collapse in the loan to deposit ratio. So typically, you know, we learn in school, deposits make loans make deposit. The loan, usually there's about a 1-to-1 loan to deposit ratio. And with COVID, what we've seen is that loan to deposit ratio has collapsed to less than 0.5 for the big four banks. In some cases, Wells Fargo, for example, is because they're not allowed to, but even the other big three, just there has been this lag in loan issuance. And the question is what happens next? And we can go with your theory that, you know, now that banks are making money again, they're going to do buybacks again, and that's where this extra capital is going to be returned. Or we can go with what I think is more likely, which is the inflation review, which is we have all these kind of trapped kinetic energy in the banking sector. I calculated if you just look at the big four, and if we wanted to go back to a normal loan-to-deposit ratio, not even pre-2008. Let's go post-GFC, meaning with all the new prudential regulation. So if we were to go from 0.5 to 0.8 on the loan-to-deposit ratio, the big four banks would have to issue more than 2.5 trillion in new loans. So I think that's something that, again, the market is not really discounting. I mean, we have our eyes on all the infrastructure spending plan, the family plan, the COVID plan, you know, all these. There seems to be a new one every week, a new $2 trillion plan. Well, I would add there's a hidden banking stimulus. And I could see it happen in 2021 with a perfect storm for banks, right? Because you have steeper yield curve, so now it's profitable against to issue loans. They have generally over-provisioned their losses. You saw that in the earnings of JP Morgan, right? I mean, they were able to release some of these extra provision. Some of that they have too much capital. So, you know, why keep that capital earning zero as excess reserves at the Fed when you have, you know, an economy that's booming, a consumer that's ready to go out, real estate sector that's on fire, steep yield curves. So that could add to this inflationary pressure. And again, inflationary pressure should not be an early stage. Typically, at the early stage of a rally, yeah, you see some pickup in commodity prices, right? Because they're the most cyclical, but the stickier parts of inflation, whether it's wages or rents or bank lending, do not pick up quite yet. And I think this is what we're going to see, which is, again, more consistent with a late cycle dynamic than an early cycle one.
I think that point about share supply is interesting. I mean, that is often the IPO mania of, say, 1999, 2000 is often pointed to as kind of the pin that popped the bubble, that just oversupply of shares into the market. And, you know, on the flip side, though, you've written pretty eloquently about what you call this big blob of money that's kind of chasing bubbles from place to place. I just want to read a quote from the report, because I think it's true and it's interesting. You write, quote, "The blob has created a rotating bubble from long bonds to big tech, work from home stocks, to reopening sectors, electrical vehicles to SPACs." And obviously we could add Dogecoin and whatever else, NFTs to that list, I imagine. So to me, I guess the play is, you know, it's almost impossible to identify the top of a bubble and to say short a bubble right before it pops. But it seems to me like the play for you is more kind of, you know, getting ahead of where that blob is going to go next, right? I mean, there's swollen savings accounts in the U.S. because of the government stimulus, the unemployment benefit enhancements, you know, and just the lack of places to spend your money last year, your disposable income. So is that it, Vincent? Is the best move now not trying to time the pop of the bubbly parts of the market, but try to get in early on the next bubbles in the making?
Absolutely, yeah. Per your point on the difficulty of timing bubbles is impossible at the best of time. And now we have the situation, the bubbles don't burst. Like the blob just moves, but it leaves wherever it was in a similar state of evaluation. Like you look at the ARK ETF. So clearly, you know, this story to me is kind of over, but we haven't had the big, you know, 80 to 90% drawdown that would have expected, you know, the way it played out with the NASDAQ stocks in the 2000, right? Just kind of stays there. So I would not try to short it, but I would try to guess where the blob is going to move next. So I would think there are three areas that have not been touched by the blob, and I'll quickly talk about each one of them. So let me start with the one that I don't believe in, which is GARP stock, growth at a reasonable price, the quality names. I've seen a lot of strategists, you know, get into this stuff, or, you know, consumer staples, some healthcare stocks, for example. These are the last parts of the market that the tech obviously was overvalued to start with. Then we had the reopened small cap that, so really what leaves you with, like, you know, a handful of stock in consumer staples and healthcare. I'm not excited about that, mostly because of my belief that inflation is going to come here, and that is going to come stronger and longer than people think, and you really don't want to be in these kind of stocks. So the parts that I'm more excited about are, playing some reopening trade in Europe, Mexico, which is by far my favorite short-term call, and then precious metal. Do you want me to start with any particular order?
Yeah, you know, I was going to ask you about Mexico. I think that's an interesting one. I mean, obviously, a very sort of cyclical-oriented benchmark stock index. I mean, a lot of commodity producers, energy producers. That's not all of it, though. I know you're one of the few strategists I've seen actually use the Big Mac Index to determine that the peso is undervalued. So I know that's part of it, but yeah, get into Mexico a little bit for us about what are all the sort of bull cases for Mexican stocks for you?
What I like about Mexico, it's really at the intersection of what I think are the four big stories of 2021. One is this stunning commodity rally, which, you know, for Mexico, the biggest Achilles heel has always been Pemex, which, you know, is horribly run, structural decline, difficult relation with the government. And, you know, this was an accident in the making, right? I mean, people thought, okay, this is going to hit in 2021. And like, it's like a lifeline. It's like a gift from heaven. With oil prices above 60, these guys are going to, they're not going to be great. They will never be great, but at least that's a problem we don't have to worry about. And in general, you know, Mexico, energy and oil is a huge part of Mexican GDP, so that they benefit from that. Second theme is the U.S. consumer, which, you know, keep surprising to the upside. I mean, we saw it again with the latest job numbers, consumer, I mean, just keeps getting better and better. And that benefits Mexico. I mean, 50% of Mexican GDP is exports to the U.S. So it's probably the economy that has the single most leverage on the U.S. consumer. It also plays out via remittances. So we have all these Mexican workers that are working in the U.S. and they'll all be collecting the stimulus checks. And you know, back home, you know, things are still pretty bad. I mean, the Mexican economy suffered a lot last year. So you'll see a lot of money come back from the U.S. to Mexico, creating flow, selling the dollar, buying the peso. I think it's already up 25% year over year. And as we get more stimulus, I expect that to continue, especially as the construction sector improves in the U.S. You could see this money flow back in. Third big narrative for 2021 is steeper yield curves, which benefit financial. Again, you look at the Mexican index, huge weight of banks and financial, which is typical of emerging markets, which tend to benefit from steeper yield curve and rising yields. And then the last theme is more kind of a secular theme, but it's this ongoing competition or outright cold war between the U.S. and China, which means that you'll see a preference for shorter supply chain, more regionalization of trade. And of course, Mexico, which had suffered so much from the rise of Asia, the maquiladora sector suddenly is very competitive again, in large part because people don't want to have these long supply chains. And also because the peso, as you mentioned, is very undervalued. If you look at the Big Mac index, it's undervalued by about 60%. And if you look at the current account deficit of Mexico, I mean, Mexico has been a deficit country for ever since I was born. For the first time in, I think, 35 years now, Mexico has a current account surplus. So here you go, very undervalued currency, perfectly aligned with energy, with the U.S. consumer, with steeper yield curves, and then also a lot of pessimism about Mexico. Like, people are very negative about AMLO, and I don't think it could get any worse than that. So, you know, as usual, you want to buy the stories. You know, you want to buy things going from, you make most of your money when things are going from very bad to a little bit better. Not, you know, this is the best time to invest in an emerging market.
Well, can we talk a little bit about north of the border as well? Not an emerging market, but, you know, has a lot of similarities to Mexico from a cyclical perspective. And given the fact that I sit up in Canada, you know, why do you like Canada so much? Is it the stock market? Is it also the loonie, which I believe is one of the best performing currencies this year?
Yeah, I feel everything I said about Mexico applies to Canada. I would say to a lesser extent. I personally prefer Mexico because I think you have more leverage than you do in Canada. You also have less of a risk of, Canada, the big problem is, of course, the real estate bubble, which seemed, again, it's postponed year after year. I mean, people have been calling for this to burst for 10 years now, and they've been wrong every year. So maybe it doesn't burst, but still, I mean, in Canada, you have this lingering question. Again, I think you can play it either way. For, you know, more conservative investors, clearly Canada is a little bit less risky than Mexico. But I think in terms of risk reward, I prefer Mexico.
Yeah, Yeah. So, Vincent, if I'm a listener, sort of a retail trader at home trying to figure out, well, how do I play Mexico? How do I play Canada? I feel like a lot of U.S., say, non-institutional investors get a little nervous looking overseas at companies. Is it, you know, is this something you would play with ETFs or somehow a sector-based strategy? How would I, as like Joe Schmo listening at home, play Mexico and or Canada?
Yeah. So one of the issue with the Mexican ETF, the main one, is the the index is very skewed towards telecom company and Walmart, which may not be the best bet for what I'm describing. I think it's mostly, honestly, it's a currency play, even a fixed income play as well. One of the issues that investors are facing in 2021 and even before is, you know, the 60-40 portfolio is dead, right? I mean, especially that 40 segment is dead. Like, what are you going to do with your fixed income allocation? And you have very few places in the world where you can replace, you know, U.S. treasuries. I would say Mexico is one of them. I mean, I like Asian fixed income and I like Mexico, especially on the short term. I mean, you have everything that can play out. You can see the spreads compress. You can see the currency strengthen. And then you have a very nice coupon in Mexico. Yield curves are very, even in the short end, they're quite high. So maybe you played fixed income. And then if you wanted to, I have a way around it, which I like, is to play with Spanish banks. If you look at the major Spanish banks, they make more money from Mexico than they do Spain. And that's a way to maybe get less of country-specific risk. And also with the Spanish banks, and that brings me to my next idea, which is you get a play on the reopening of Europe, the reopening of the tourism sector, which is going to happen this summer, and you can get them. I mean, we're talking, you know, most banks in Spain trade at 0.5 to 0.7 book value, 9x earnings. So you get about a 50% discount compared to U.S. banks, and you get a play on Latin America, reflation, the weak dollar, the reopening of Europe, steeper yield curves, which to me are all going to be the themes of 2021.
All right, so Vincent, we've been to Mexico, we've been to Canada, where Divya is, even though she doesn't like hockey. I don't know. You might get more hate tweets about that, actually, Divya.
That's actually true. I feel like I've now put out a lot of negative thoughts out there.
So tweet.
There's just way hockey, too much fighting. Way too much
hockey
fighting.
Fans tweet at Divya. And but let's stop now. Next port of call, Vincent, is in Europe. And I want to read another line from one of your reports. Granted, I'm reading this mainly because I find it hilarious. So let me just read it here. You're talking about you took a trip to see some family in France, and not too long ago, I guess it was April, maybe late March, and kind of sounded like full-on lockdown conditions were still in effect. And you write, quote, "Restaurants, cafes, bars, bookshops, museums, and theaters were closed, making Paris as boring as Geneva." But so, Divya, Vincent's going to get some hate tweets from the Swiss as well. So direct them to Vincent. You can copy me on those too, because I'm dying to see those. But you refer to it though, Vincent, as what you call peak COVID despair, meaning, boy, everyone was just sick of lockdowns. There were starting to be conspiracy theories flying, much like here in the U.S., and just kind of a dangerous situation. But to me, is that kind of contrarian instinct picks in and makes me think, well, that sounds like the time to buy the reopening sectors, the, you know, maybe the hotels, the airlines, that sort of thing, the banks, as you mentioned, the Spanish banks, European banks, which, boy, talk about something that went from radioactive not too long ago to it's interesting to hear a bullish take on it now. But I mean, is it as simple as that, you know, when things look like they're at their worst in Europe, that's the time to really get bullish on the reopening?
Yes. By the way, I don't think this is something that Americans understand about how bad the lockdowns have been in Europe. Like, it always amuses me when I see Americans like, you know, throw such like tantrums about, oh, the mask, oh, like, you know, try going to Europe where literally like you're stuck in your home, and you know, if you go out without the right piece of paper, you know, that you're gonna get a 150 euro fine. I mean, if only fines cured COVID, France would totally lead the world. Like, if we could have, you know, we couldn't produce vaccines, but paperwork and fines, I mean, we were leaders there. And yeah, it's been very frustrating in Europe because this is like lockdown number 3 or 4, right? I mean, it's like, I do think it's the last, right? But, you know, people have, you know, it's almost like a hope management strategy. They just keep, no, this is going to keep going, because so many times they've been told, okay, now we're going back to normal, only to shut down 2 months later. I do think this is the last. Yes, Europe botched the vaccination program at the beginning. So did Canada, by the way. You know, we were late, and that cost a lot of lives. And that, you know, that allowed the variants to spread. And this was a horrible policy mistake. No questions about that. But, you know, we're what, 2 months behind the U.S. vaccine stop. You look at infection in the U.S., this is when they started going down the cliff. So now, we, you know, all the vulnerable, all elderly, sick population is now vaccinated in Europe. They're getting to people in my age group. Then you'll get the weather, you know, same thing that happened last year, right? We had a big outbreak in May, March, April, and then we had a very normal summer because people start going out, the virus doesn't spread as much. And then just politically, I think the reason why we had the lockdown in Europe in April is so that we could open in May, June. Like, you know, Macron and Draghi, they're smart people. They know the importance of tourism for the European economy, and they basically needed to get that curve to look like it's going down a little bit so that they could say, okay, fine, now we reopen, let's have a normal summer, because we cannot afford another summer of lockdown. So we'll have the same dynamic, and it will be magnified, because in Europe, you know, vacations are a religion. People have been cooped up inside. Even last summer, the tourism season for the places that were open was actually very good. We saw higher bookings than normal. So yeah, what is the conclusion? You play the reopen in Europe. In the US, it's done. Like, it's more stuff. You look at the hotels, the airlines, the restaurants, it's more expensive than it was before COVID. It's insane. And sometimes by a lot. While in Europe, if you look at the major airlines, I would say we're still 50% below pre-COVID high. If you look at hotels, about 30 to 40%. So we have this catch-up that, you know, I think could happen in the next couple of months.
We talked about Europe, we talked about the US or North America, we talked about Mexico. Where does Asia stand in all of this for you? I know you mentioned the Japanese stock market in your report, but where does Asia stand, or where should Asia be in a person's portfolio at this point?
In general, and maybe you can get into that later, but my view is Asia should be that fixed income, 40% of fixed income should be reallocated towards Asia, because of the different policy response, because of the demography, because of the potential for currency appreciation. So I think as people retool their 60-40, look at Asia for your 40%, and look at Asian government bonds. In terms of equities, I mentioned Japan. I like Japan for, I think I view it as the anti-US trade. If you buy the US or even just a world, MSCI world, you'll end up with so much weight into these, you know, 6 or 7 US tech stocks, right? You're no longer getting any sort of diversification. While Japan is a lot more diversified because it's much higher weight in industrial, much higher weight in consumer discretionary stocks. So, you know, it doesn't have that concentration problem. The second reason why I like Japan is, again, the supply and demand argument, which is exact opposite as that of the US, where, you know, in the US, we are seeing an increasing float because buybacks are weak, new offerings are very high, and right now it's being absorbed by retail flow, but my concern is that this retail flow will eventually dry up. In Japan, I think we're eventually going to run out of Japanese assets. Like the Bank of Japan has already monetized half of the public debt. So, I mean, the JGB market is just structurally shrinking. Same thing on the equity side. You know, they buy ETFs every month. I think right now the Bank of Japan owns something like 10% of the Japanese stock market. There's zero new issuance. There's buybacks because Japanese firms, there's big movement for corporate governance reform in Japan. So you just see a structurally shrinking float. And as a result, prices are rising. I mean, no one cares. No one cares about Japan. But if you look at the performance of the topics since Abenomics, since 2012, I mean, it's just been straight up. With also remarkably little correlation with the rest of the world, which is something else that I like. Because I think that's, again, as 60-40 portfolio dies, one thing that we're going to see is, and I think we've seen that already, is that negative correlation between stocks and bonds. Like back in the days, it was very easy, right? If you had stocks, you just put 30% of your money in long-term treasuries, even though the yield was not great because the diversification was so wonderful, it really improved your Sharpe ratio. So that's all you need to do. You only needed to buy treasuries to diversify an equity portfolio. This, I think, is not going to happen in 2021 if we see higher inflation, if we see, you know, stocks and bonds going down at the same time. So you have to be smarter about diversification. And one of the markets with the least correlation with the rest of the world is Japan, precisely for the supply and demand reason I was describing.
Stand clear of the craziest things we saw in markets this week.
All right. Well, Divya, we're going to drill into the craziest things we saw in markets this week. Vincent, I know this is a favored segment of yours as well. Divya, I'm going to put you on the spot. Let's start with you. What's the craziest thing you saw in markets this week?
You know, I have to say it's really hard to figure out what the craziest thing is on any given week. I mean, we are in a world of Reddit traders and Dogecoin.
Yes, right.
Having said that,
as an equities team leader, you haven't seen anything crazy all year.
Nothing ever surprises me anymore. But yeah. Here's something wild. A bottle of wine that was aged for 14 months in space at the International Space Station is now up for sale, and it could fetch up to $1 million. This bottle is being bundled with an Earth-aged wine so that the buyer can taste test both of them and decide which one tastes better.
$1 million for space wine. I dig it. I like it. I don't know. Hey, hats off to the astronauts who didn't drink that while it was up there. You know, I would have... I think I would have downed that thing about the second night in space. I don't know. So
yeah, it'd be very hard not to.
They must have hid it somewhere, you know.
I think it was in like some kind of steel cased cylinder, so no one could get to it anyway.
Yeah, you don't want drunk astronauts flying the space station. I guess that could get ugly. But all right, Vincent, that's a pretty good one. That's a tough competition. You got a anything that can top $1 million bottle of space wine? It is a red, I guess. It's a Bordeaux, right?
It is a Bordeaux. That's right.
A space Bordeaux.
No, I don't think anything can top the space Bordeaux. No, I actually went outside of markets because, you know, the markets in general are crazy, right? So my anecdote is more about actually the healthcare. I saw that Americans took 1.5 pound for every month since the start of COVID. So I think on average, people have put on 20 pounds since the start of COVID, which I thought was pretty crazy because it's not like we started from a healthy base. And it kind of brings me, jokes aside, to kind of like my secular call on healthcare and also to some extent inflation. I think, you know, as we come out of COVID, there's been damages to the bodies and the minds of people. I mean, this has been extremely hard, and we'll be dealing with long COVID for the people who had COVID, but also for the long lockdowns, if you will. The consequences of that will play out over the next 10 years. I think you'll see much higher healthcare spending because of the issues that we've accumulated with COVID. And also potentially inflation. One of the big debates with the Fed is, you know, or we can push the unemployment rate below 4% because participation is low, right? That's the Neil Kashkari argument, that you have this reserve army of workers that have dropped out of the labor force. We could come back anytime. I think COVID has actually shrunk that reserve army, and we have like a much higher structural unemployment due to mental and physical health issues as a result of COVID. And that, to me, increases the risk that the Fed is going to mess up and it's going to be too late because they don't understand the level of slack in the economy, labor market.
Well, I will say that I am guilty of that pound and a half per month, I think. I've probably put on 20 myself, but I've been trying desperately to take it off because I think we're coming back to the office soon. And I can't wear the sweatpants to work, Divya. I got to get back in the suit pants eventually. So desperately trying to take it off, but I resemble that story a little too much for my comfort. So two good ones there. I applaud both of you. I'll give you mine. Mine's courtesy of the Wall Street Journal. And this is, I think, the real sort of market plumbing wonks out there will appreciate this the most. Berkshire Hathaway's Class A share price has gotten so high that the NASDAQ can't quote it anymore on some of its popular data feeds. And actually, the newer exchange, IEX, had a similar issue. So here's the sort of wonky explanation, again, courtesy of the Wall Street Journal. NASDAQ and some other market operators record stock prices in a compact computer format that uses 32 bits or ones and zeros. Stock prices are frequently stored using four decimal places to the right of the dollar sign. So in other words, sub pennies. So the highest possible price you can quote Berkshire at is $429,496.7295. So I don't know why you need to quote a $429,000 stock in sub penny increments, but I guess there's some market maker out there making a quarter penny on these trades. So I don't know what the solution is. They have some kind of bug fix in the work that they can begin to quoting Berkshire again, but I don't know, Vincent, maybe a stock split or something. Maybe it's time for Warren to consider a stock split.
He always said he was against it. So, but it's a great story. You never disappoint, Michael.
Well, you guys have not disappointed me. Really appreciate your time. Divya, good luck with those tweets. Whew.
I'm definitely going to need them.
Yeah, you might want to just log off for a couple weeks. I don't know. And Vincent, always great to catch up with you. Appreciate your time, and hopefully we can do it again.
Thank you.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Reganonymous. Divya Balji is at Divya Balji. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. And thank you to Charlie Pellet of Bloomberg Radio and the voice of the New York City subway system. What Goes Up is produced by Topher Foreheads. The head of Bloomberg Podcast is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.